Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
This is Radio at Firehouse.com. This is Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Welcome. It's good to have so many people so interested in this show. We're amazed at the feedback we get and all the emails and all the comments and stuff, so hopefully we're delivering something to you that's of value. This week, we've got two outstanding guests. You're going to love this. We've got Chicago Battalion Chief Steve Chikoroidis. Steve is the author of a wonderful book called Firefighters from the Heart. It's a book of 46 short stories that have impacted Steve. But what's really cool is with each of the stories, he provides lessons learned. So you can actually use this as both an interesting book, a storybook, if you will, but also you use this book for training, for personal training as well as for organizational training, using these case studies, so to speak, as a part of your regular training program. So it's really neat. We'll be talking with Steve in just a little while. And also my other guest is the author of Rescue Men, former Boston Globe journalist Charlie Kenny, who tells a story of three generations of firefighting in his family and the fires and the incidents, including political stuff, that changed their lives. And the name of his book is Rescue Men. So we'll be looking at and talking to the writers of both Rescue Men and Firefighters from the Heart in just a few seconds. But first, some discussion, some headlines, and some news stuff that's going on. We really would have to be blind to not understand that we seem to be having a lot of apparatus crashes lately. Somebody wrote me the other day and says, wow, what's with all the apparatus crashes? I don't know if we're having any more than we have in the past. We'll see how those numbers play out. But we're certainly not having any less. And the fact of the matter is, there ain't no great secret to solve these problems. I've got a whole lot of emails, people asking questions. Let me tell you, the solution is slow down, stop at red lights, stop at stop signs, put your damn seatbelt on, and we'll make most of these problems go away. Now, is it easier said than done? I don't know. It's up to you. It's up to me. When I get in my car and respond to a call, or you get your apparatus, respond to a call, how bad do you want to get there? And sometimes a few seconds will make a big difference in getting there and saving somebody's life, but you got to get there. So, we got to figure this one out. In Osceola County, they had an engine company struck, but they were blocking the highway. The truck was destroyed while operating on the Florida Turnpike, but the fact of the matter is they were protecting their personnel and not a firefighter got hurt, and this just a few weeks ago. There's been some apparatus crashes in Detroit. Tragically, a few weeks ago, fire apparatus operator Joe Torcos, a 47-year-old firefighter, died when a speeding dirtbag with a gun, cocaine, and two kids in a Chevrolet Tahoe rammed the apparatus that Joe was driving. He was ejected and thrown from the apparatus, as well as the fire officer was ejected as well, and the dirtbag also died. But this is another reminder of us having to get to the scene if we're going to do any good. Speaking of blocking, seven patients were transported to area hospitals last week in Prince George's County, Maryland, after a Rescue Squad 47, had all their emergency warning devices activated. They came to a stop to turn into the access ramp of a highway, and they were struck from behind. The squad was struck with such force that it was knocked over onto its side, injuring the four firefighters on board. So luckily, everybody survived that. But again, another example of what can happen on those roadways and the extreme caution we have to use. I think probably the most well-known, or sadly the most well-known crashes that we're currently looking at right now are the ones that happened in Chicago a week ago Friday, between that school bus and a Chicago truck company. One of the firefighters, probably by the time you hear this show, most have been released from the hospital. At the time of this broadcast, firefighter Jim Biganis is the only firefighter still hospitalized, and he is in good condition. Sadly, Chicago firefighter Billy Grant. William Grant was killed in the crash. The bus driver involved in the accident was cited last weekend for failure to yield. But there's also a lot of discussion about whether the rig went through the light, who was seatbelted, who wasn't, and stuff like that. And hopefully that will come out so we can learn from that in honor and memory of firefighter William Grant of the Chicago Fire Department. And in North Carolina, two members of the Road Staff Volunteer Fire Department were killed last Saturday. Billy Harold Williams, 45, and Brandon Whipple, 19, were both pronounced dead at the scene. Firefighter Williams was driving, and Firefighter Whipple was the only other member on the apparatus. One of them was ejected and thrown from the vehicle, and the other was pinned under the vehicle. The crash happened just before noon, and reports are that the wheel slipped off the roadway. The driver overcompensated, trying to get control. He couldn't, and it caused the rig to go out of control. The fire chief is quoted as stating that, tragically, he did not believe either firefighter was seatbelted in. I understand how difficult it is to put your seatbelts on, but damn, man, your apparatus gets in a crash, it seems to make a big, big difference. And then right after that, in North Carolina, in Catawba County, a firefighter was seriously injured in a car crash. He apparently ran a stop sign, and somebody struck him, and he may be permanently paralyzed. This was in his own personal car. More and more bad news. Slow down, stop at stop signs, stop at red lights, and put on your damn seatbelts. And I think that'll probably solve most of the problem. Let's talk about some fires for a minute. Winnipeg, Canada, a terrible, terrible fire several weeks ago killed Captains Harold Lessard and Captain Tom Nichols. A senior firefighter is now recovering at home from that fire. He suffered very serious injuries in that house fire that killed those two captains I mentioned. Each captain, by the way, had over 30 years on the job. These were not rookies. Firefighter Ed Wiebe is the last of the survivors to be discharged from the hospital. He was released last Thursday, according to Winnipeg Local 867. Wiebe suffered severe burns on that February 4th fire when a crew was caught in a flashover and they were trapped in there. They were searching the home to make sure that nobody was inside. Cigarette ashes and a plastic garbage can in an attached garage started the fire. The firefighter Wiebe, lost some of his fingers and has gone under or has underwent multiple surgeries, having to go to the hospital every day. He's doing well, but his injuries were quite severe. Wiebe spent considerable time in critical condition under constant observation and intensive care, and he has survived, but he's got a long ways to go, and odds are he'll never return to firefighting. Stand down. It's stand down time. The IFC has announced the third International Firefighter EMS Safety Stand Down. This year's stand down is going to be focused on being ready to respond. The dates, write these down. The dates are June 17th to the 23rd. June 17th to the 23rd includes both weekends this year, so all fire departments can participate in this activity. The IFC Safety, Health, and Survival section will be coordinating with the IFC staff, the IFF staff, and the IFC EMS section. For further information, there's a link down at the bottom here. Click it, go to Stand Down, and check it out. Make sure your fire department has it on the calendar, and you are scheduled to be involved in it. It won't cost you a thing. You can do it all locally. And you know what? Maybe you talk about wearing seatbelts. Maybe you talk about the dangers of flashovers. Maybe you talk about the importance of getting a line on the fire. But you're going to do something so you don't have to go through some of the stuff we're talking about on this show. Plan now, appoint the right people who will get this done at your fire department. Set up committees, task forces, or whatever, but get your fire department engaged. Everyone involved. Involve anybody who rides your apparatus. Make it an event at your fire department. Spend just half the energy on this that some of us do on fun details, and the stand down will matter at your fire department. Set up some hands-on back-to-basics drills. Whatever the case may be. I mean, something. I get a little frustrated talking about this because somebody says, well, what are we going to do with the stand down? Well, go to the website. There's tons of stuff that you'll be able to do, becoming involved. I mean, they talk about ready to respond. Here's a good outline for you, a stand down drill outline. Let's say you got a single family dwelling fire. So how would we discuss this or prepare for it as a part of the stand down? Well, since the title of this year's stand down or the focus is ready to respond, let's take a look. What would you do for a single-family dwelling fire? Well, before the run, you'd look at things like apparatus readiness, staffing, alarm assignments, dispatcher roles, making sure your radios work right. We'll talk about radios in just a minute. what channels and channel coordination you use on that fire, mutual aid training, pre-plans, map books, physical fitness, health and condition of your members. Is your PPE ready? How does that PPE fit? Do you look like the Michelin man when you put your gear on? Is it time for new gear or is it time to eat more salads? What's in your PPE? What do you carry in your gear? Rope, flashlight, chocks, gloves, tools. So that's how you would prepare before the run, so that ties into the ready to respond. And then what about responding? Well, driving, knowing where to go, seatbelts, stopping at red lights, stop signs, riding assignments, equipment, who brings what off the rig, and the officer supervising. So that's how within responding you'd be ready to respond. And then when you get on the scene, what would you do? Well, ICS, personnel tracking, company assignments, staffing resources, water supply, pump operator, stretching the initial hand line to the fire, backup lines, forced entry, venting, search, rescue, RIT, staffing qualifications. I mean, you get it, right? You understand what I'm talking about? This is the stuff that we can use to prepare for the stand down. So check it out. Go to the link down below here, www.isc.org/standdown, and get your department involved. The International Association of Fire Chiefs, speaking to the IFC, is alerting its members. Now look, if you use digital radios, 800 megahertz digital, 500 megahertz digital, whatever digital radios you use, listen to this. The IFC is alerting its members to a potential issue and soliciting their input to a solution. The IFC has received several reports of firefighters experiencing unintelligible audio communications while using digital two-way portable radios when operating in close proximity to low-pressure alarms of their self-contained breathing apparatus. In addition, other common fireground noise, including powered tools, apparatus, and path devices, may affect your ability to use your digital radios. That's good news. This is an industry-wide issue and not specific to any one manufacturer's radios. There are indications that any digital voice communication product utilizing the voice encoders that all digital radios have can be affected by this problem. The IFC does know the problem is not related to any specific radio spectrum. It is not a frequency of operation use. The bottom line is if you use digital radios, you need to go to the IFC website. I have the link below and get involved and find out what you can do to determine whether your radios will have a problem. They got a test you can perform, a drill you can perform to help determine if you have a problem, and they are working on solutions. This has some potential major issues. When do you call a mayday? Well, when your low air alarm is going off would be one example. Well, if you key up your digital radio, your low air alarm is going off, and it overrides your ability to call the mayday, what do you do? Your input is vital to ensure that digital radio technology can be effectively used in fireground applications. The IFC fully understands that many fire departments are using digital radio systems and they've had success, but there may be some very serious issues related to voice transmission being interfered with or overridden when common fireground noise is in the background. Check out the link, figure out what's going on, follow the suggestions, and you'll be able to avoid any problem at your fire department. Have you seen the report from the New England Journal of Medicine regarding firefighters suffer more heart attacks? Coronary heart disease is the leading cause of firefighter death, and we certainly know that, and we've been talking about it, whether it be on this show and many of the other places that you've heard from the National Fallen Firefighters, from the IFC, from the IFF, National Volunteer Fire Council. Everybody is focused on the issue, of heart problems within our job. But I want to talk to you for a minute, and down below is a link to that study on heart disease. But I want to talk to you for a minute about the federal games that are being played. You know what they are. Federal fire games are when good members of the Congress and Senate approve things for us, you, me, meaning firefighters, and then some other folks, which could be power-struggling federal employees, cranky elected officials who don't like us, you know folks like that, who work in the federal government, and they decide that there's really no rush in getting it done. What is it? It is the stuff we worked hard to get, such as firefighter death benefits, fire act grants, and usually in the big picture, it, quote-unquote, isn't even measurable as far as the rest of the federal government's spending. All we're asking for is some small change that will have a big impact. The Congress and Senate basically said, please do this, And when it gets to the federal level, someone or a whole lot of someone's kick back, smiling, and relaxing in a very Andy Griffith, I'm in no rush kind of way, they say, well now, what do we have here? Let's see. Hey, Goober. Hey, Barney. Hey, Floyd. Hey, Aunt B. Looky here at this. Well, this might be what Congress wants done, but, well, we'll get to it, maybe, or maybe we'll just say no, and we'll let it sit. And there it sits. After all, what we need doesn't affect government bureaucrats. Actually, and quite honestly, we might be better off with Andy and the gang. They seem to care, as opposed to some federal employees. So what's with the federal fire games? Well, you know this. Despite the passage of the 2003 Federal Hometown Heroes Act, no claims for firefighter medical line-of-duty deaths, that's the heart attack stuff I was just talking about, have been paid by the federal government. Nothing. Not a penny. None. And this has nothing to do with USFA folks, you know, the United States Fire Administration. They're some good, real good fire folks at FEMA, and they're often our last hope in getting stuff done. But this has everything to do with bureaucratic folks who have no clue as to what you and I as firefighters do. And they probably couldn't care less, unless it's their smoke detector going off. The Hometown Heroes Act established a statutory presumption for public safety officers, which is firefighters, all firefighters, who die from a heart attack or stroke during or following a non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical public safety activity or training as having died in the line of duty. In other words, if you do something related to your job, generally it should be looked upon as a line-of-duty death if you die of a heart attack or stroke. That's more clearly defined if you read the paperwork. Anyway, that's what Congress and Senate wanted, and that's what the Congress and Senate directed. Now, go ask the family members of any medically fallen firefighter how it's worked out. It hasn't. There are a series of articles that MSNBC came out, and they talk about the fact that there are numerous firefighter families left holding the bag with no benefits being paid to them because the Department of Justice or whoever else at the federal level has decided not to spend the money. When was the last time you contacted your member of Congress or your senator? It's time to check in again in order to find out why honoring their request is such a problem, and why some claim that the current administration is intentionally holding the funding back. And talk about timing. Last week was the 19th annual CFSI National Fire and Emergency Services Dinner in Washington, D.C. I sure hope most of us, instead of glad-handing and smiling and having our pictures taken with our federally elected officials, ask the hard questions, such as why aren't the medical line-of-duty death benefits being paid off? We need to ask the questions. We're entitled to it. They approved it. What's the deal? More delays, more federal games. In the big picture, firefighters really don't ask for much. Jeez, many of us do it for free, and the ones of us who get paid for it rarely get rich and almost always work side jobs. But if you take a close look at the big picture and zoom in, you'll find hundreds of firefighter families of fallen firefighters left holding the bag, the empty bag. It's the game prize. Do firefighters, meaning all of us, you, me, and the rest of us, own the heart and stroke issue and problem? Sure we do. To some extent, we absolutely do. And that's why we are working hard to reduce the numbers. We absolutely need to improve in the safety and health and survival issues, and we are. But what Congress and the Senate did is what they did, and that was done by them to benefit firefighters who give their lives and leave people behind. 50 or so families are left behind each year without their rightful benefits because their loved one had a heart attack or stroke related to their job as a firefighter. In a time where it is hard to get real happy about much that's going on in Washington, D.C., this should be a no-brainer for elected officials who are looking to score points, just like in a game. So down below are the links related to this. Write, contact, do whatever you need to get in touch with your member of the Senate, your member of Congress, to find out what's holding up the funding. And while you're at it, ask them where the Fire Act grants are for this year. They're again overdue as far as releasing the paperwork so fire departments can apply for Fire Act grants for next year. Again, maybe more games being played. I don't know. We'll see. Well, look, we're getting ready to bring our guests on. As I said, we've got Steve Chikoroidis from the Chicago Fire Department, who wrote Firefighters from the Heart, and I've also got Charlie Kenny, who wrote Rescue Men. We'll be back in just a few seconds to hear the interviews and spend time with these two great gentlemen.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, we're back. This is Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Got two very special guests with us today. And, you know, a lot of times on this show, we talk about some extremely serious stuff. And indirectly, we're going to be talking about some serious stuff when we have these two guests join us in just a few minutes. But we're talking about reading, and there's a lot of great fire books out there these days, and in years past, whether it be Ray Downey's The Rescue Company book, or Dennis Smith's numerous books, John Salka's, Tom Downey's book on The Last Men Out. I mean, there's so many books out there, and I like to try and focus on some of the more applicable or more recent books especially, but the two guests I have are going to be sharing with you their motivation and what their books are all about from two different perspectives. One is a family member of firefighters, and one is a firefighter. So my guests that are joining us today is Charlie Kenny, who wrote the book Rescue Men. Welcome, Charles.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely a pleasure. And Steve Chikorotis. Did I get it right, Steve?
You got it right, Bill.
Okay. Steve's a battalion chief in Chicago, 27 years on the job, and both have written books clearly about the fire service, but from two very unique perspectives. We're going to first chat with Charlie for a little while. The folks and the men in Charlie Kenny's family have been drawn to firefighting since his grandfather Charles Pops Kenny joined the Boston Fire Department in 1932. I want to make sure I translate it right in case
you got that really. You did that really well, Billy.
In his working-class Irish Catholic neighborhood, there were other jobs that offered a decent wage, but none had the sense of belonging or serving the community that comes with being a firefighter, or the purity of purpose that comes with saving lives. Pops Kenny was on the scene of the notorious Coconut Grove Fire in 1942. For you younger firefighters listening to this show, Google Coconut Grove Fire, and you'll understand the fire, and perhaps Charles will talk about that in a little while with us. The author's father, Sonny Kenny, served with distinction until an explosion blew him from a third-story window. And two of the author's brothers were fire buffs, or sparks, as they call them in Boston, as children, amateur firefighters, whose career goals were thwarted by a court order integrating the Boston Fire Department and changing the rules for employment forever. One became a cop, the other a paramedic and a rescue man in an elite squad sent to Ground Zero in the aftermath of the collapse of the World Trade Center. Spanning 60 years of firefighting history in America, Rescue Men is some book. And I had a chance to be a reviewer for this book, and I absolutely was thrilled with it and strongly recommend this for reading. So, Charles, talk to us. Tell us, first of all, what motivated... Well, now, let me just say that you are an author, and you're a
yes.
former journalist at the Boston Globe.
Correct, yeah.
You co-authored nonfiction books, Keep the Faith, Change the Church, and you're the author of John F. Kennedy, The Presidential Portfolio, as well as novels The Last Man, Code of Vengeance, and The Son of John Devlin, and you live in Boston, Massachusetts.
Right.
So tell us about your writing history a little bit. What are those books about, just very briefly?
Well, I've written all kinds of different things. I'm really interested in writing fiction and have three novels that have come out, and they're kind of thrillers, mostly set in Boston, but you know, mostly set in the neighborhoods and the communities that I know. The nonfiction books, which I also enjoy doing, I like doing different sorts of things. The Kennedy book was tremendous fun for me. As you know, the JFK Library is here in Boston, and it's an amazing resource for primary source documents, so that was a great experience. But I'm also interested in other things that are happening around me. In the Catholic Church scandal, I was raised Catholic, and the Catholic Church scandal was something that I really felt I wanted to write about, so I did that. And I've done a number of other things, but I have to say that there's nothing, I've never really had an experience, I guess I've written 8 or 9 books, but I've never had an experience like this experience, because it was writing about family members, and it was writing...
You had to use easy to understand words in large print, probably, for the fire service.
Well, for my brothers, of course. I have 5 younger brothers, and And as I say to them, I wrote it in crayon originally so that they would really be able to understand.
Outstanding.
It.
And now we're communicating.
Yeah. But it was really a unique experience to write about my family, but also to write about the thing that's been kind of at the center of our family, the nucleus of the family, going back for a couple of generations, and that's firefighting and the Coconut Grove fire. If you grow up in Boston in a firefighting community, as I did, I grew up on a little street in a neighborhood of Boston where there were seven houses, and literally every single house was owned by a firefighter. So we the parish, the school was filled with sons and daughters of firefighters, and you go to Mass on Sunday, and the talk afterwards at the donut shop was all about the fires the night before or that week or whatever. And so we were really immersed in that culture, and we had a kind of a unique position because we were the family whose grandfather was one of the first to respond to the Coconut Grove, and in Boston,
right.
That really holds that that's hallowed ground, and for very good reason.
What was a defining fire, too?
It was a defining fire nationally and internationally, but here it's still hallowed ground because, I tell my kids and their friends that there was this fire many years ago at this nightclub, and almost 500 people died in a matter of a few minutes, and it's hard for them to grasp it. It's hard for them to understand, but, that's the reality of what happened.
I guess the next... nearest thing to that, which probably brought up a lot of memories for some of the old-timers, such as your dad and others, was when the Station nightclub fire occurred a couple of years ago.
Yeah, my dad lives on Cape Cod, and he got the night that fire happened, he got a call at 3 in the morning from a firefighter friend down in Providence, and my father woke up, answered the phone, and all the guy said was, "Charlie, it's happened again."
Right.
And that was a horrible tragedy, and to me that is such a violation of the legacy of the Coconut Grove, because the legacy of the Coconut Grove is that we do everything we possibly humanly can under the codes to keep people safe in those environments, and that's what makes the Coconut Grove, that's the positive side of the Coconut Grove. You have to get something positive out of that horrific tragedy, and the positive side is the code enforcement, and that fire should never have happened, and it's really a violation of that sacred legacy, and very, very unfortunate. And now you can only hope that the lesson of the Station fire gets sort of marbled throughout the country and the world, and that never again is there an event like that.
Well, I know that the codes definitely changed in Rhode Island, but unfortunately it's a very human thing to try and forget, move on to whatever's next.
Yeah.
And we don't always, you hear people say, "What's it going to take? Having to kill somebody before things change?" And sometimes even then, things
right.
don't always change.
Right.
Let's go back to your book. Your dad retired at the age of 40 after he was blasted out of there, and he really never let go of the fire service after that. He was involved in the firefighting supply business, and also did a lot of research on the Coconut Grove fire. So you is this one of the things that sparked your interest to write a book? How long have you wanted to write a book about the fire service?
I hadn't really been interested in writing about it at all, and one night I was talking to my dad, and he had been researching the Coconut Grove fire for years and years and years, and whenever you go visit him, there's the old metal filing cabinets and all the memorabilia, and he's got tapes and he's got records and documents and photographs, and you could sit there for an hour and talk about it, or you could sit there for 10 hours and that's what he talked about. And I heard his voice one night on the phone, and he sounded kind of tired. He was getting kind of old, and he sounded kind of tired, and he had planned to take all of his research and turn it into a book.
Uh-huh.
But he hadn't written a book before, and it's a difficult thing to do, as anybody knows who's done it, and it takes an awful lot of time and energy, and taking all of that massive information, it's almost harder to write it, I think, because he had so much information. So I sort of said, okay, well, you know, I'm going to drive down there tomorrow and we'll have a chat. And I went down and I sat down with him and I said, you know, how about if I tackle it? And so that was the beginning of it. I really felt as though I kind of owed it to him, and I really felt as though, you know, it would honor all of the great work that he had done. And, you know, as I get into it, I wrote a different story. I didn't write the story of the Grobe per se, although that's part of it. I felt I should write a broader story about the family and about how enormously important the firefighting culture is for certain families, and the pluses, the good and the bad. But at the end of the day, it's the kind of thing that really knitted our family together and was definitely the most important part of my dad's life and my grandfather's life. So once I started down that road, it was really it was very exciting to do.
Well, and absolutely, the book is not specifically a book about the Coconut Grove fire. As you said, it talks about it, but it really is a book I saw it in a couple different levels. One, it's a book for all firefighters to read, to reaffirm that interest, that love, to relight the candle, to re-spark your ignition on why you love being a firefighter. Because as much as we love what we do, there are days where we wonder, why are we doing what we're doing? And normally it's nothing to do with the calls we go on. It has everything to do with the politics and the related BS we deal with,
right,
in trying to either justify our existence against city hall slugs wanting to cut budgets, cut staffing, cut equipment, or dealing in some cases with people who wear firefighter clothing but have not earned the right to call themselves brothers or sisters, or bosses who definitely don't get it. So this is a book that will reinvigorate your interest and love in being a firefighter. So that was the first level I saw. The second level is a book for families of firefighters or those who don't get it. In other words, all of us as firefighters are surrounded on a daily life with people who love us or care about us, or are friends or family or whatever, or for volunteer firefighters, even employers who don't understand why you do what you do and things like that. And this book is a great here, read this to help them understand that I guess the best thing I can tie into this is, and Steve, you being from Chicago, and Steve's going to be our next guest in a few minutes, that movie Backdraft years ago where Donald Sutherland made the statement, the funny thing about firefighters is you're always firefighters, night and day, no matter what, you're always a firefighter. And that's so true, and this is what you read in Charlie Kenny's book, where being a firefighter was the focus of everyone's life. My dad's a firefighter. My uncle's a firefighter. My brother's a firefighter. And that really were the two levels that I picked up on that.
Well, it's really interesting you say that. Second point is a really interesting one, because about 3 days ago, I had a friend of mine who's a lieutenant on the job in Boston come to me, and he actually grew up, he's younger than I am, he grew up with some of my younger brothers, and I ran into him. He's assigned to a station literally within about a quarter mile of my house, and I ran into him. And he grabbed me and he said, listen, I've got to tell you this story. My mother-in-law never really, I always felt she didn't get it. I always felt she had this little attitude about my job. And my wife gave her your book and she called me up on the phone and she was in tears and she said, I'm sorry, now I understand. And yep. and he was so pleased that she got inside of the story and she the way she put it to him was, I now understand that when you go into this profession, it takes you in its embrace.
It's
it holds you in its embrace, and that's it doesn't right. let you go. And I thought, what a great way to put it.
Well, and that's why I picked both yours and Steve's books, because if a firefighter purchases these two books and uses them for any of the above purposes. Now, Steve's book carries it one more step. There's a third level where Steve's book teaches lessons learned, and it's very, very interesting. We'll talk about that in a minute. But specifically for your family, for your friends, for those who don't get it, between Charlie's book and Steve's book, it solves a whole lot of problems and helps people truly understand what we do. Now, what were some of the things that you experienced going through when you were doing the research, talking with people, when you did Rescue Men? What are some of the stories? There's got to be some cool stuff that happened along the way that really changed the direction of the book or kicked it up a notch or something like that.
Yeah, no, there were some terrific moments along the way that really, you know, were so inspiring for me. And one of them was there was a particular firefighter who had worked with my dad pretty early on in his career, and he my dad had never really talked that much about wasn't that he was secretive, but it was, you know, he's kind of a stoic guy, and as my grandfather was very much a stoic guy, but this young firefighter told me a story about how my grandfather, he had heard this partly through my father and partly through another old-timer who had been at the Coconut Grove fire. He told me a story about how at the Coconut Grove, my grandfather rescued a bunch of people at one particular exit. And then my grandfather was overcome, was taken to the hospital. About a month and a half or 2 months later, a call came from the head nurse at Boston City Hospital, who was trying to find, to the fire department, who was trying to find out who in the first few minutes of the fire was that firefighter at the Shawmut Street exit, this little cobblestone street where hundreds of people tried to get out of this exit and were jammed in the exit in a terrible situation. And they went back and looked at the records, and actually they talked to the captain, and the captain said absolutely that was Kenny. And the nurse then went and contacted my grandfather, who was recuperating at home in a neighborhood of Boston and having a very difficult time with the whole thing. And she called him and went and visited him and talked to him, and she said, look, there is a young girl who was badly injured in the fire. She was burned. Her name is Dorothy Miles, and she was the nightclub singer, 17 years old. She was there. She's from New York. She was there with her mom, who chaperones her, and she was sitting there doing her algebra homework before she was due to go on, and she got caught in the fire, got very badly burned, and she is disconsolate, and her mother is staying with her in the hospital, and she's going to be in the hospital for many, many months. Would you be willing to go and visit her? Because we think if she meets you, she will be reaffirmed that she needs to live and that there was this person who risked his life to save hers. And there was this incredibly dramatic meeting at the hospital where my grandfather went in and met with the mother first, and then they went into the room, and he couldn't go near her or touch Dorothy because she was so badly scarred and burned.
Right.
A beautiful young girl, but, you know, scars all up her neck, her face, etc. And the part of the tragedy was a week later she was supposed to have a tryout with the Dorsey Band. She was that good, and so she's in the hospital, my grandfather goes in, and my grandfather's a very shy man, a very reticent man, and he just sat there and kind of, apparently in kind of awe, because he never talked about this. He talked a little bit with my dad, but even after all the conversations I had with him, he never told me about that. But sort of learning about that from a guy, sort of third hand, and then be able to trace it back to my dad confirming that, yeah, in fact, that's what happened. And then my dad goes and he pulls out this massive correspondence that happened through the years after this meeting with my grandfather and Dorothy, and Dorothy was very moved to meet him and very sort of energized to meet him. But there was this massive correspondence. They stayed in touch. Both families stayed in touch for a couple of decades after that, and my grandfather and grandmother were guests in their home, and my grandparents invited them to our house. And so there was a real relationship and a real connection between my grandfather and Dorothy and her mother, and there was this incredible gratitude by Dorothy that my grandfather had given her life. The other part of the story was that there was a doctor, a surgeon, a really famous surgeon at Mass General Hospital across town, who donated his services over a period of, I think, of 7 years, and Dorothy had something like, and don't quote me on this, but it was something like 60 surgeries, and this surgeon did this for free, and it didn't restore her to her original form, but it got her pretty close and got rid of a lot of the scarring.
Wow.
So going through that detective work and finding that connection was interesting. My dad later visited her in New York. She was singing at a small club in New York, and he went down for one of the firefighters' communion breakfasts down there, and he visited her and sort of closed.
She's still singing today?
No, she unfortunately died some years ago. Yeah.
You know, that's interesting, and one thing that I'm kind of a fan of, because my dad was a part of this, as they describe as the greatest generation, and that's what you're talking about here. It's almost, in some respects, numerous parts of your book talks about the greatest generation in firefighting as well. Now, let's move from the family stories in the Coconut Grove to two areas I'd like you to talk about before we go on to our next guest. One, I'd like you to talk about the issue, and it's very clearly pointed out in your book, the issues of the firefighters not getting appointed and not getting the job due to court orders and things. And I also want to talk about, or have you talk about, the tie-in to your brother who was at the World Trade Center, an interesting tie-in there.
Yeah. My two of my younger brothers, I have five younger brothers, and two of them from a very, very, very early age wanted in a very desperate way to be firefighters. They grew up
Boston firefighters.
Specifically Boston, absolutely.
Right.
With all due respect to Chicago. They watched both of my grandfathers were firefighters. My father was a firefighter. The neighbors were firefighters. The friends were firefighters. Everybody was a firefighter. And they admired these men greatly, and they really worshipped them in many ways, and particularly my grandfather and my dad, obviously. And so from a very young age, my brothers Tom and Pat were fire buffs, and they were at the firehouse on their bikes when they were little, and then they chased the fire down the street if they could reach it on their bike. And then when they got older, they, through friends of my father's, would be in downtown houses. They'd stay overnight. They'd ride the rescue because you could be inside the truck. They got to know lieutenants. They got to know captains. They got to know district and deputy chiefs. And they were, you know, they were part of the family. They really and truly were part of the family. They would go routinely to Engine 24, Ladder 23, one of the busiest house in the city, and they knew everyone there. They were part of the crew. They could do the work.
Right.
Time comes for them for my brother Tom, who's the older of the two, to take the test, and the test is based on the Red Book. You read the Red Book. You study the Red Book. You take the test. If you pass the test, you know, if you get one of the highest scores, and then you take the physical exam, you're on. That's the way it had always been done. My brother Tom, throughout high school, essentially committed the Red Book to memory. I'm not exaggerating. My brother Tom is a very smart guy, and he sat through high school, and he would read, when he was supposed to be doing his biology homework, he was going through the Red Book, and it's, I don't know, 280 pages, whatever, civil service gobbledygook, but he committed that thing to memory, and he knew it frontwards and backwards. He's taking a test that is being given by a district chief to prepare kids for the test. And the test is for this little course that's being given by the district chief. There's no charge for it. He's just doing it as a friend and volunteer. And he puts the word out. And, of course, 95% of the young guys who are in the class are related to firefighters, because that's the word goes out that way. That just happens to be how the culture is, as we all know.
Right.
So he's taken the thing, and, you know, they're literally a week before, 2 weeks before the test is going to be given. The chief comes in that night. He's ashen-faced. He's clearly upset, and he says, guys, it's all over. We can't give this test anymore. The court ruled today, the federal court in Massachusetts ruled today, that the Red Book, the test cannot be based on the Red Book, and they're going to do a race-based selections.
What year was this?
This is 1974.
Okay, go ahead.
And so there was much confusion in the wake of that, but then the papers in the days after that explained exactly what happened, and, you know, Boston, to its shame at the time, had a 23% minority population, and 1% of the fire department was minority. So there really hadn't been the type of effort to go out and say, look, to people of color, and say, look, this is a great job. You should consider this job.
Right.
And so, you know, so if you do that, maybe you get it to 7 or 8% or 9 or whatever, but it's, at least it's not 1. You know what I mean? At least there's, you've taken away the grounds for that type of lawsuit from the NAACP. But anyway, that's what happened, and there were appeals, but the appeals were denied. And for some years after that, you know, many years after that, both my brothers just kept taking the test and taking the test. And, you know, the passing grade generally was 70, and the passing grade for the minority applicants was 35. And so my brothers really, it was sort of the perfect storm. It was exactly the wrong time for that to happen because it went on for a number of years. And one of my brothers just said, okay, I'm going to become a cop, and he did that. And my brother Tom said, you know, I want to be a rescue man, and he became a EMT and then a paramedic and was on the first paramedic unit in Boston and did truly amazing work. And then he went to Cape Cod, became a firefighter in Hyannis, and is on the FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Team out of Massachusetts, and it was the first team to arrive in New York from that wasn't a New York team on September 11th. So he went through that experience, and that was a you know, obviously
an interesting
tie-in. That was a defining experience for him.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you get
absolutely.
There. He's riding on the bus down there, and they're looking around, and they train really hard. They train really hard for this type of stuff. He's a real expert in building collapse. He teaches building collapse. He trains hard on that. You know, he's ready. He's going down there, and they're talking on the bus. They see the site from a distance, and they're talking, you know, we're talking, you know, hundreds. We're going to rescue 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And they get to the site, and he's walking along, and he's looking, and there's this powder on the ground, and it's sort of strange. The powder is everywhere, and there's no indication of any whole things. There are no computers, there's nothing from an office that's identifiable.
Sure.
And he's thinking, here are these towers with like 10,000 offices and a million pieces of equipment, and there's nothing. And then it was then that he realized that everything had been, you know, just sort of
obliterated. That was the end of it. Yeah.
That they did find. He had some solace. They found a number of. Obviously, they found many body parts.
Right.
They found one whole person, and they referred to her as the China doll, and they found her under the pile, obviously, but she was this girl, beautiful girl in her late 20s, and she was totally intact, her entire body. She was lying there on her back, level, and arms by her side, eyes closed, and they examined her, and she was just, you know, some sort of trauma obviously killed her, but she was really totally intact, and so they, with unbelievable care, obviously, and attention, took her out of the site, and they felt at least that one family got their child or their wife back.
That's a big deal.
That's the thing. That's what he says. That's a big deal, and that's absolutely what they hold on to this day. So
I'm on the board of directors of September 11th Families Association, and I get a lot of opportunity to talk with and deal with the families. And I'll tell you, a piece of bone or anything is a connection to some of these poor folks who've not gotten anything since the loss of their family member.
Right.
Well, we've been talking with the author of Rescue Men, former Globe journalist Charles Kenny. We have some links at the bottom of the website here that you'll be able to click to figure out where you can purchase his book. Probably the best bet is Amazon.com, but there are some other excellent booksellers that offer this. Any final quick words before we go on to the next guest?
I just want to thank you, Billy, very much for this opportunity to talk to firefighters and their families. It's wonderful, and you do amazing work in this area, and I just want to tell you how grateful I am.
Well,
so
it's
thank
a pleasure.
You.
We're glad to have you. You're listening to Radio at Firehouse.com. We'll be back in just a few seconds with Chicago Battalion Chief, 27 years on the job in Chicago, Steve Chikorotis, who is now an author. We'll be right back.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
We're back. This is Radio at Firehouse.com. You're listening to Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. My next guest today is Steve Chikorotis, who is a battalion chief with the Chicago Fire Department, who wrote an amazing book called Firefighters from the Heart. It's a book of 46 short stories, which is great because most firefighters have about a 1 or 2 minute span of attention, that shaped and molded his career, as well as stories written through interviews of firefighters such as retired Boston Fire Commissioner Leo D. Stapleton, retired FDNY Captain John Vigiano, former Chicago Fire Commissioner Ray Orozco Sr., and the current commissioner, his son, Ray Orozco Jr. All these firefighters shared so many inside life-altering experiences so we can learn. And what really struck me about Steve's book is not only does he have these stories, but also there's lessons learned with each story. So it's kind of like a training book. And I don't know why this book would not be required reading in any firefighter training program, especially at the probie level, but perhaps even at the fire science level and promotional levels. It really is a unique book that I've not seen before, where there are stories for interest, entertainment purposes as well, but also lessons learned. So I want to welcome Steve to the show. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Billy, thanks for having me. I'm honored to be on your show.
Well, you've done a great job with this book, not to mention what you did, all the stuff you've done on the job over the years in Chicago. And what motivated you to do this, especially in this style? But I'll stop talking and you talk to everybody for a while. Just give us an idea. What motivated you to write this book? You're a firefighter and a fire chief by profession. But also, I'm really interested in why you decided to share the lessons learned.
Well, Billy, I was motivated by the same thing that motivates you. We just have too many line-of-duty deaths in the fire service, and it really hasn't slowed down over the years. I currently have about 28 years on a job, and I'm a battalion chief, but for a while I was both the assistant director of training and acting director of training, and I had an office that every morning I had to walk down the hallway, and there was 563 badges on the wall. Each of those badges represented a firefighter that died in the line of duty in Chicago. Each represented a family that was missing their loved ones. And I don't see the fire service is getting safer. I see it becoming more dangerous. Even though the fire count is down, the fires are more dangerous for, I believe, three main reasons. The fires burn hotter. It's due to the synthetics that are introduced into society every day, every year. The fires grow a little bit hotter.
Sure, we remind firefighters, this isn't your father's fire, and this is not your father's smoke. This is a whole different animal we're dealing with these days.
Oh, without a doubt. And if buildings are weaker, lightweight construction. Lightweight is a terminology that it's cost effective and not life effective. It's definitely more dangerous. In our early years in the fire service, we used to look at older buildings as the dangerous buildings because gravity was already against them, and they were weakening by age, and now they were weakened by fire, where now the newest buildings, if they're lightweight construction, actually are the most dangerous. And then the third thing that I feel makes it so dangerous is there's less fires now than there ever was before. I know I'm going to a lot less fires in my career at this point, and I'm in a busy battalion, but I'm going to a lot less fires than in the past. And there's some areas that are going to, very frequent fire calls, which really, I think, adds to the danger, because your skills aren't as sharply honed when you do arrive, and the fires are every bit as dangerous and more. So I feel that the next best thing to be in there is firefighters with experiences sharing their experiences. And we've been doing this for years. We've been taking the new kids when they come in and taking them under your arm and teaching them the ropes, talking about things that happened in the past so that they can learn from it, because the same thing is bound to happen in the future. That's the whole...
Well, you know, that's a great way of looking at it, Steve. I sort of knew this, but I haven't phrased it this way. By reading your book, it's an opportunity to sit down and listen to the lessons learned by some of the best senior men in the business.
I think so. But that's the whole basic principle, is why I got the idea for the book and why I wanted to write it. And then the next thing was whose stories. You know, I had a bunch of experiences that I wanted to share and that I did share in the book. But then I went around the country and I grabbed some people like you've talked about already, Leo Stapleton from Boston, Johnny Vigiano from Merck, lost his two sons when the towers came down.
Right.
I have Chief Bobby Hoff from Chicago, Pat McCullough from Dallas, Texas, again, Billy Carter, who lost his whole truck company. There's just countless stories from a bunch of great individuals. Our current Commissioner Roscoe and his father, who was previous Commissioner Roscoe in the city of Chicago. But just a wide range of firefighters from small towns and large cities. I get stories from California, Florida, Missouri, and something that came out in your previous interview is true, is firefighters are firefighters. And wherever you go, you see that you meet the same type of people, kind of a, I call them a noble breed of people willing to risk their life for total strangers. And the problems that we face are really the same. Fire is fire, construction is construction. There, you have variations in different areas, but there's lessons to be learned that can be shared wherever, and they can make the job safer. And that was the whole basic principle and motivator behind the book.
What? Now, I don't want to put you on the spot, because it's like saying which of your children are your favorite, but I'd like you, if you can, to share with us maybe the two or three stories, maybe not your favorite, but ones that you want to make clear to our listeners today that impacted you the most. Which of the two or three of the many interviews or stories that you talk about in the book really stuck with you? And I know they all did, but certainly there's got to be a couple that impacted you one way or the other that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You know, there's a wide range of lessons. There's lessons on construction and collapse, fire behavior, tactical considerations, even things on physical fitness and motivation, and things that sometimes are lacking from certain areas. The tradition, dedication, honor that comes with the job, and this was stressed from some of the best in the business. I had some real emotional interviews. And then I would try and write the story to make the firefighter or reader feel that they were there. I feel that's the best way to not just teach them from an educational standpoint as far as traditional classes, but almost to input some instinct where they feel that they've been there in the past when they find similar conditions in the future, such as if the condition was a spongy roof. You can read books till you're blue in the face about, you know, if the roof is spongy, it's a sign of weakening of the structure.
Right.
Get to the sidewall, get to your ladder, get off the roof immediately. But if you read a story that makes you feel that you were there and you had that close call, I think it reaches home a little bit more. And hopefully that's the whole basic principle behind this job, or behind this book, is to keep badges off the wall, keep firefighters, coming home safe. And also to educate the civilians. But getting back to some of the stories, there was definitely some emotional ones. I'll take Jimmy Sandis from Rescue 2 in New York. I drove out there flew out there and drove out to his house in Long Island, and I was sitting at the kitchen table with Jimmy and his he's a firefighter on Rescue 2 and his wife Donna. And it started out, the interview he was sharing was a nice rescue. and there was a lot of lessons to be learned in the rescue in itself, but I was getting more out of it from the interview. I could see the love of a firefighter's family and an example of how firefighters' families were coping with the stress post 9/11. And I wrote the story with both, where the lessons could be shared through the experiences in the rescue, but I also encompassed the part of the interview, just an example, on 9/11, actually on 9/12, the next day, Rescue 2 lost several members there, and Jimmy, one of the survivors, and his partners, of course, were busy working there.
Right.
A group of us from Chicago came up the same day, but there was just thousands and thousands of rescue workers covered in dust. Your eyes are stinging. It's hot. It's fruitless. You're hoping that you can find a void where you can find some survivors, but,
right.
but you're starting to feel that you're not. And Jimmy forgot to call home. He never called home, and he has a family that's just having a hard time coping, waiting to find out if he's okay.
Sure.
All of a sudden, in the middle of the day, he gets tapped on the shoulder by a firefighter who hands him a cell phone. He takes the cell phone and says, hello, and it's his wife, Donna. And she says, Jimmy, you have to call. You have to call. You have to let me know you're okay. And he says, Donna, how did you find me, and who is this guy that gave you the cell phone? She said, take a look at him, Donna, or Jimmy. And he looks, and it's his 16-year-old son, Michael. He grabbed some old gear out of the garage in Long Island, somehow made it as close as he could, probably ran about the last several miles because no vehicles could come in there.
Sure.
And like a miracle, found his dad on this mountain where everybody looked the same. It was just an amazing story.
That is incredible. I was there for 3 weeks, and you couldn't tell one from the other.
Right.
Absolutely. That's a great story. Talk to me about, if you can, your interview with Captain Vigiano. Not only was he one of the highest decorated firefighters in New York City history, but he's known as a hero, known as a wonderful guy. But then he lost both his sons. One was an emergency service cop, and the other was a firefighter.
He did. John is just one of the most impressive firefighters and impressive men that you'll ever meet in your life, and he had a loss with his only two sons that none of us can even imagine how great a loss that is. But he's been an old friend, and we both had background on Rescue 2 with myself in Chicago and John in New York, and just a legendary guy, and he's one of the first guys that came to mind when I was writing this book. But I didn't want to cover his sons unless that's what John wanted to cover, and John just gave a nice interview, which I wrote the story from, about leadership. That's the strongest message coming out of John's is just on leadership, and this is again coming from one of the best. Another story that pops into mind because. It's someone, all of these stories are people that shared from their heart, is one of our deputy commissioners, Bobby Hoff, is a longtime friend of mine.
Super, super firefighter, great guy. He's chief of operations now, or is he first deputy? What's his rank now?
He's an assistant deputy fire commissioner.
Okay, and he's involved with operations, though, right?
He is, in operations,
yeah.
Correct.
Bobby's a great guy, and he's actually on the list to have on the show here one of these days. And
that's great.
Yeah, he sets a great example for sure. Talk about that.
He does. Well, Bob, we've crawled the same hallways for several years, and he's been badly burned in a flashover. He's survived a lot. He's done some great things, had some great rescues. He's one of our highest decorated firefighters on the job. And the story that Bob chose to share, again, coming from his heart, happened 12 years before he came on the fire department, and it was the death of his father, Chief Thomas Hoff, in February of 1962. And it's just a tremendous story. There's strong lessons learned, and Bob shares the emotion of both the from the firefighter aspect, as far as, you know, how did things happen, what mistakes were made, how did his father die, the burden that other firefighters had to bear, people that I'll give you a little bit about the story, was at the time his father was running training, and he got sent to this fire, because we carry fire duty even with those
sure.
positions.
Right.
And our longtime commissioner at that time, Commissioner Quinn, shows up at the fire, and he was trying to back people out. And this is 1962. It's before firefighters were carrying radios, so everything would be done verbally. There was a lot of yelling, and they're trying to back everybody out because they noticed the conditions of the building, which was a big apartment building, were weakening quickly. And a lot of firefighters responded, and a lot of them did what firefighters have done over the years, and they get that thing, well, they don't know how it is right here. You know, just give us one more minute, and we'll have this thing. So they delayed a couple minutes. So right away, the commissioner sent Chief Thomas off and another guy, Chief O'Brien, in to evacuate the building. And they hustled up, got to the top floor, started herding the remaining firefighters down, cleaning out floor by floor. As the last firefighter stepped out onto the back porch, the whole building came down, and it buried Chief Hoff. It buried Chief O'Brien and Chief Hoff's driver. His driver was talking to him for about a half an hour, and then all of a sudden Hoff couldn't talk anymore. He was gone. The driver ended up being rescued, and the other two weren't. Emotional part of this story, there was a chief on the job some years back. At this time, Bobby Hoff and myself were both working and training as partners, and there was a chief that was getting ready to retire, and he said, Bobby, I have to sit down with you and talk. And the two of them went into a room, and he shared that he was the last firefighter out of the building that was saved by Tom Hoff, and he's felt guilty all these years. He's felt like it was his fault.
Carried that burden.
Bobby's father died, right.
Yeah.
And Bob was big enough to he hugged the guy and said, you know, I don't want you to carry this guilt anymore. We've all made that same mistake, and we learned from it, and we learned from it. And again, that's what most of these stories are about, is people sharing mistakes. Sometimes things are great in these stories. There's stories that are would bring a tear to a glass eye. There's humor in some of the stories, because that's the firefighting world. But every one of them has a hidden message, whether it's meant to share what really goes on inside the smoke with the civilian reader, or more importantly, to educate the firefighters, both young and old. I've gotten emails from firefighters. One guy from L.A. County, he said he had, at the time when he emailed me, he had six shifts left till his retirement, and he was telling me how much he enjoyed the book. And then I get books from school kids saying that they never really understood what their father did for a living, and they do now. So it seems to be working.
Well, it certainly is a very popular book. I know I've heard from a lot of firefighters, and I've seen some emails, the opportunity to have you share a little bit of that book with us today is certainly appreciated. And is there one message that you'd like to share with firefighters before we wrap this up, as far as what they should look for in your book? I agree with you. Between your book and Charles' book, Rescue Men, the two of them together really is a great combination of helping people get it, helping people understand what we do. And honestly, maybe it's a book or that you would want to give to a city budget director or a city manager or a mayor. Those people constantly don't get it. And perhaps this would be a good tool as well. But, Steve, as far as wrapping it up, what would be your final message to firefighters in relation to your book or anything else you want to share with them?
You know, Billy, I would just say always be a student of the game. You know, I'm in my 28th year, and I realize that I still have a lot to learn, and I'm always, you know, striving for more information, whether it's from your website or books that I pick up or classes that I teach or classes that I attend, and that's the way we have to be. That helps keep badges off the wall. It helps make us more effective as firefighters in the safety of civilians, and it helps us protect our brother firefighter. So,
I think if any of our guests ever have a chance, and you're in visiting Chicago, stop in at the Fire Academy and take a look at that display. The lobby of the academy in itself is a little museum, but to see the badges, it really does drive home the issue. The less badges, the better we're doing. Steve, before we wrap this up, I also want to, and I know I'm speaking on behalf of everyone here as well as all our listeners, our deepest condolences in the loss of firefighter William Billy Grant, who was killed last week in that tragic apparatus crash.
Thank you. I'm going to be leaving right here for Billy's funeral, and it is very emotional. Billy was a great man, a great family man, and a great firefighter, and he's truly going to be missed in Chicago and in the fire service. It's just it is a big loss.
We're talking with Battalion Chief Steve Chikorotis, 28 years on the job in Chicago. His stories are true depictions of actual events that allow you to also learn from these. You know, the old term, pass it on, and a chance to sit and talk to your old-timers or your senior members of your house. This book does that, and it takes you from L.A. to New York and many, many cities in between. Small towns, too. It's not just a big city book. So this great, outstanding opportunity we have to read, brought to us by both Charles Kenny, the author of Rescue Men, and Battalion Chief Steve Chikorotis, the author of Firefighters from the Heart, True Stories and Lessons Learned, is just two books that, honestly, I strongly recommend you have. Now, somebody just asked me recently when I saw them, do you get sponsors for your show? Like, if you're talking to somebody who wrote a book, are they paying you to do it? Absolutely not. This is freewheeling here. I say what I want, talk about what I want. That was the agreement with Firehouse.com when we started this. I have nothing to do with these books except that I read them, and I wanted to share these with the folks who listen to the show. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Billy, you are truly one of the greatest in the fire service with all you've done to keep the job safe, and it's an honor and privilege to be here.
Well, see that, you don't pay me, but I'll certainly pay you for that comment. Appreciate that.
If I could just mention where people could pick up the book?
Absolutely, yes, Steve, sure. And we'll put some links on the website here, too.
Thank you. The publisher is Thompson Delmar Learning. Their website, www.firescience.com. You could also get it from local fire service book distributors or local bookstores such as Barnes & Noble and Borders, and probably one of the easiest ways is Amazon.com. But, Billy, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Firefighters out there listening, be sure to please check out Steve's book and also Charlie's book. We're going to wrap this show up. I'll look forward to seeing you, many of you, just in a few days at FDIC. We'll be doing some classes out there. You'll see us walking around the show, the exhibits, and we're also going to be involved in the fundraiser again, that big party that they have every year for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation through American LaFrance. So anyway, you're listening to Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We'll see you soon. Take care. This is Radio on Firehouse.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.